Joining me in the studio now is Frank Kelly Fries. He is well known to science fiction buffs for his visual creations of strange creatures, strange places, strange vehicles, strange people. He began doing cover illustrations for magazines like Astounding Science Fiction, Weird Tales, and Fantastic Universe in the mid-1950s when the pulps were beginning to fold. But Fries' career took off. He has received 10 Hugo Awards from the World Science Fiction Society. He has been elected Dean of Science Fiction Artists, a Lifetime Award by the Eastern Science Fiction Association. The posters that he designed for the space program became the first posters to be exhibited at the Smithsonian Institute. A patch designed by Fries traveled through space on the shoulders of the astronauts of Skylab. Those of you who do not indulge in science fiction and fantasy are probably familiar with another aspect of Fries' work, Alfred E. Newman, the strange What Me Worry Man of Mad Magazine. Kelly Fries, welcome to Fresh Air. It's really a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'd like to start by talking to you about the early part of your career. When you started drawing illustrations for science fiction magazines, how would you describe the market as having been at that time?
Negligible. It was, at that period, there was not enough work being done in science fiction to make a living for anybody, even the best writer in the field. It was for all of us. A labor of love. We got into it because we enjoyed doing it, but we made our living other ways. And when I first went to New York, I would get perhaps two or three drawings a week to do, possibly a double-page spread and a couple of black and white spots. This would, for me, be a week's work. But I only got $10 for a spot and $35 for a double-page spread. It didn't lead to high living exactly. But gradually the field broadened. I found myself within a couple of years working for all the magazines. At one point there was, I believe, in 1 month, there were 14 magazines on the stands and I had covers on 12 of them. I probably had black and white illustrations in the other two, but I don't remember.
What about the content of both the illustrations and the stories in the 1950s? How would you describe them? You speak in your book, which I have a copy of, The Art of Science Fiction, a book of your illustrations and your comments on the illustrations. You speak very lovingly about the great care that the writers used at that time to pick just the right science fiction cliches for their stories.
This was a matter mostly of planet stories. The cliches were more important than the plots, really. The wanton witch women of Argus and this sort of weird thing that... it sounded very salacious, but the stories were really quite mild. There was never any overt sex, as became the fashion later on. Science fiction in the old days tended to be very much in the Rover Boy tradition. It was a literature strictly of ideas and gadgetry, a man who couldn't write for sour apples if he had a good idea for a gadget. Would work it out in a science fiction story, and the readers would love it. The real period, the golden age of this type of story, was probably from about 39 to 45. And then gradually John Campbell got his writers interested in developing characters instead of just cardboard cutouts that went through the motions to advance the ideas. Nevertheless, there was some absolutely fascinating concepts. There was a story called Jupiter's Joke, I believe it was, back in the mid-40s, which was simply two men fell into a polished parabolic mirror, a virtually frictionless surface, and they slid down one side and up to the other side, but that word virtually was the joker in the deck because they didn't quite make it all the way, and then they slid back down again. And it was the problem story of how did they get out of it. This was the type of thing that really sent us into ecstasies at that period. Then gradually the problems of the individual took precedence over the gadgetry. You could no longer sell the story of a man who opened a can of paint that was meant to cover everything and did. How does he get it off before he suffocates? And we come into stories that really are of more value to us and are a lot more fun to paint. The stories that involve the technology of the future, but the real action is the solution of human problems of the man who is faced with this technology or this social setup. I find them much more interesting myself. I thought in 1956 or 7, I thought that science fiction had just about come to an end. I felt that there might be enough still floating around to keep us for a few more years. Since then, I've read some of the best stories you've ever read in my life.
You were talking about how writers started relying more on real characters and character development in science fiction. And I guess the same was true of the way you started illustrating, using more people.
This is true. Especially, Campbell himself had more to do with that than anyone, I think, because he was the first receptive market for characters in illustration. And I always did have the feeling that the people in the stories were more important than the gadgetry, even though I enjoyed doing the gadgetry. And to develop characters became a real pleasure to me, reaching its final climax in the series that I did for Harlequin Books over the last 2 years, each one of which had a character. Then I reached a point where I was digging for characters. I had enough of that, too.
When you're drawing a character, will you go to the writer of the story and ask him or her about the facial details they've envisioned for the character that they wrote about? Or is that strictly your realm? Do you have license to say, okay, this character has a rather prominent nose, large ears? You know, who has rights over that, really, between you
actually,
and the writer?
Actually, what I try to do is follow the description that the author gives as far as he gives it, and then add my own flips to it. Sometimes this gets me into trouble. There was a story by one author. I found out later that it was very important to her that her particular group of people were absolutely hairless. But the cover painting that I designed, the character that I wanted to use, absolutely required a mustache. So I painted the mustache in, requested that the editor, I called him and asked him if he thought the author would mind writing in a sentence or so would have done it, because there were a couple of occasions in which the man was in disguise, could have done it that way. But nothing happened, and the author was absolutely furious when her hero appeared with a mustache.
So what did you do?
Suffered. I didn't do anything. I mean, what can you do? You can't. All you can say is, "I'm sorry, I blew it."
But the illustration got left in with the mustache.
Right.
Okay. We were talking about how science fiction was and how it has developed after a point when everyone thought it was, you know, maybe even dying out. How do you see the state of science fiction now? I mean, in what ways has it developed in the last 20 years?
Science fiction has a very strange way of going in waves. Now, I think we are at the beginning of one of the biggest waves of interest in science fiction that has yet to surface. We've seen the Star Trek craze. We've seen it come. We've seen it not quite go. There are a tremendous number of people vitally interested in Star Trek even now. Star Wars is just beginning to build up. I think there is going to be a lot more excitement about it, especially as the sequels come out. And, of course, this is going to spawn any number of atrocities, as they are always do. And there will be more magazines to come up and probably to go down. But the point is that we have raised a generation now that are aware of the interests, the fascination of space, and they are not going to be satisfied with anything less than the exploitation of these dreams in their literature. I'm delighted.
Yeah, I guess there's more markets that have opened up, television, film, record jackets. There's a lot of fiction illustration for that. Have you done any record jackets?
Yes, I've done quite a few of them. As a matter of fact, I just finished one for Queen.
Oh, how nice.
Which took my original robot from Astounding Science Fiction back in 1953 And the band wanted him modernized a bit. And they suggested that instead of a soldier in his hand, a dead soldier in his hand, I put the band.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful.
Well, up to a point. I mean, if I put four people in this robot's hand, they're all going to be so small you can't recognize any of them. So I had two of them in his hand. One of them's just dropping out of it, and the other one is about to splatter over the concrete down below. And the robot is kneeling above the broken roof of a concert hall. Well, there we are with all of this beautiful space, and it's a fold-out. And here's the inside of the album. Now, you can't let that go to waste, can you? So we put another picture on the inside. This is the concert hall as seen from indoors at ground level, with people running in all directions. And as you look up, the robot's hand is coming through the roof, reaching for another handful of people. The band flipped over it. They love it.
When you're doing illustration, I guess it's not surprising that there's a certain amount of input either from the band that's commissioning your work or from the editor that has final say over your work. Does this ever cause any friction? You gave us the example of the writer who said, listen, there really should not be a mustache on this character,
right.
But editors also have a certain amount of final say. Is that disturbing for you, you know, that someone is going to look at your work and say, this needs something else, this one is great, but on this one you've got to change it a bit? Because really that is usually the artist's domain. No one comes in and tells an artist how to modify their work.
True. Generally speaking, I don't object to modifications that an editor makes, because he is usually making them on the basis of science fiction. Editors are by and large, visually illiterate. You simply accept the fact that these are verbal people. And obviously, if they want something changed, it needs to be changed because of its verbal significance, not its visual significance. On the other hand, the ones that I simply cannot abide are the Harvard Business School types who turn up more and more in publishing. The advertising executive whose idea of science fiction is straight out of 1933, he feels that a Buck Rogers spaceship is ideal for a 1977 cover. And this, I tend to get a bit impatient, but it doesn't pay to let it go too far. There was one occasion in which, after an hour of argument with the advertising manager, the circulation manager, the art director, and the editor, I finally said, look, it's your cover. Do what you damn well please with it. I have had it. Goodbye. I'm busy. If you want to print it upside down and backwards, go ahead. And that is exactly what they did. They printed it upside down and backwards. Moral of the story, never lose your temper with an editor or an advertising man.
Was it a mistake? What happened there?
They liked it that way. They had no judgment, but they paid the bills so they could do what they pleased with it. Now, I feel that the illustrator has an obligation to the writer. He has an obligation to his reader. This illustrative obligation is much greater than his obligation to himself as an artist. As an artist, he paints what he wants to paint. He hangs it on his walls. If people want to collect it, this is great. But if he is working to illustrate a story, if he is working for popular publication, then he is duty-bound to give the reader something that will add to the pleasure of the story. He is duty-bound to give the writer something as close as possible to the vision that the writer had in his mind. Now, I wouldn't allow a writer in my studio unless he's carried in on a slab, and I used him for a model. But to read his story and try to put into my illustration the things that he hasn't been able to get into the story, something that will make a total package that is greater than either of them separately. This is what I consider my obligation as an illustrator.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Kelly Fries, and we are talking about his work as a science fiction artist. Again, there is a one-man show of his work this weekend on the Penn campus at College Hall. There are a couple of statements that I've abstracted from your book, The Art of Science Fiction, and I'd like to, if I could, ask you to elaborate on them. They're related, I think, to what you've just been saying. The first, Abstraction has no place in science fiction.
This one sends a lot of people, simply because you would expect something as far out as science fiction to be an ideal place for abstraction to be used. This, in some respects, is true. There is some excellent science fiction art, and you couldn't call it anything but science fiction art. But it's not illustrative. The problem is that you are dealing with concepts that are so far out that your reader needs a good, solid base in reality from which to proceed. Now, if you're giving, for instance, my little blue alien, Margil, the cat girl, in order to convey the fact that she is a real person, I can't just put a blob of fur in or a blob of texture. You've got to know, the reader has got to know that this is real fur. He's got to feel that. Because the reality of the fur on this obviously feminine and delicate face is a real thing to him, and it's an alien thing. So what you're really trying to do is give him the greatest feeling of conviction that you can, so that he is led down the garden path into something completely impossible through a series of perfectly reasonable, logical, tactile steps.
Okay, what about something, though, where you want to give a feel of a certain mood? I guess that's where abstraction would come into play.
Abstraction in the sense that abstraction is a part of your composition. Remember, the subject of most abstract painting is painting. Now, we are not dealing with that level here. We are working directly with the problem of painting. So that to a certain group, for instance, of science fiction, real aficionados, you can sell space art. There is a chap in Indianapolis who does absolutely magnificent things, which sell only to a very few people, because you have to be thoroughly saturated with science fiction concepts before you can see anything in them. Mm-hmm. I think they are absolutely gorgeous, but the poor guy is nearly starving to death because it's not an illustrative thing. He can't sell it to anybody. And it, nevertheless, is what he particularly wants to do.
Maybe what you're saying ties into this other statement that I wanted you to elaborate on. Illustrative values should take precedence over aesthetics.
In illustration. That's the important part of it. Now, from the artist's standpoint, no values take precedence over the aesthetic values. But this is only from the artist's standpoint. The minute you step out of the studio and step into the external world, then you have simply got to accept the fact that your art relates to that world and adapt it to that world. Otherwise, it has no function. It has no value socially. It has equally little value economically, as a rule. The fact is that there are more opportunities for artists in our culture than there ever have been in the history of man. The only thing is that we have to learn to adapt our skills. Commercial art, and most especially illustration, begins where you leave off as an artist. It assumes that you have all of the skills, but these are the skills that you keep in the studio. I do all kinds of paintings to entertain myself. I've got stacks of them, closets full of them. They are not illustrations. They are just paintings that I've done because I enjoyed them, but I wouldn't attempt to sell them.
I'm sure some people collect them. There is a lot of sex in a lot of science fiction illustration. You have a few.
Oh, I wouldn't say that.
I wouldn't say that. You have a couple of nudes in your book, that The Art of Science Fiction. Let's talk a little bit about how sex is used and how sexiness has changed over the years. You know, like the idealization of what that, you know, luscious body should look like. Let's go back to the 50s first. Mm-hmm. What role did sensual women play in illustration?
Sensual women in that period in science fiction were pretty much the same as the sensual woman in the movies. She was always evil. Your heroine had to be a perfectly vapid, sexless, sweet little girl. But the real sex pot was the wanton of Argus, or the witch of this, that, or the other thing. She was invariably evil and almost always a brunette. I mean, blondes were the good ones, the brunettes were the nasties. You could get away with nudity, in or semi-nudity at least, in your wantons. But can you imagine Wilma in a bra and panties? No way, not even if it was brass. The amusing thing about a lot of this stuff was that the sex was implicit rather than explicit, while at the same time, is there anything more ridiculous than a spacesuit with a brassiere on the outside? This was standard operating procedure. In the sex of the spacesuit was more obvious than the sex of the wearer.
No, what? I don't mean this to sound naive, but what was the purpose of using that much sensuality of spacesuits and sensuality of people in science fiction illustration?
Well, I had a bit of a theory about it. I don't know whether it still holds water. But I had a feeling that the average science fiction reader back then tended to be a loner. He was very romantic, but he was scared to death of girls. There were no girls in science fiction. Even as late as the middle 50s, you could name all of the professional women and the fans in science fiction on the fingers of your hands. You didn't even have to include a toe. Nowadays, there are almost as many girls in the business and in fandom as there are boys. They are changing the whole face of science fiction, because one of the things that is necessary is a much more realistic view of human nature. They're treating with problems that not only couldn't have been touched 20, 25 years ago, but which didn't even cross anybody's mind to touch. The first story that I recall that made any effort at all to deal with realistic sex was Philip Jose Farmer's The Lovers. And it shocked the pants off of everybody that read it, but they were fascinated. And of course, the fact that the lovers existed in an extremely repressive society was the dead giveaway. Farmer's writing existed in an extremely repressive environment. Now the problem is perhaps the other way around. There is so much license. Your freedom to do what you please is so broad that it's like walking into an art class and having the instructor say, well, there's your canvas, there's your paints, now you've got the next hour, paint me a masterpiece. What are you going to do? And the result is that by having no limitations, you have very little structure on what you're going to do. One of the things that I admire Harlan Ellison's approach for is his effort to teach people to put structure into their stories. Now, this it may sound so elementary, but it hasn't really been an important factor in the field. The academics in the field still haven't got the point that science fiction is a totally different thing from ordinary literature. It's a different way of thinking. It's a different look at the universe. And until you get that under your skin, there is no way you can make a valid criticism of science fiction, or even a valid study of it as an art form.
Okay, you're saying that a lot of the structure and restrictions, limitations have been lifted, and that is perhaps leaving too much freedom.
Rather, in the way that physics has developed so many possibilities in its multiplicity of subatomic particles, that it has turned into virtual chaos.
Well, with that, would you say that science fiction illustration has become sexier or less sexier? With the changing an audience, you know, there's more women who are reading it, probably illustrating it as well.
You see a lot more skin, let's put it that way, but it's much less attractive skin.
Mm-hmm.
Let me stick my neck out and say that I think what has happened is that we have lost the sense of romance. And unromantic science fiction is no science fiction at all. Now, when I use the word romance, I mean it with capitals. I mean romance in the purest sense of the term.
Now, that's probably, in a sense, also what you're saying when you say that science fiction has a completely different world than literature fiction.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Okay, and that's also, in a way, what you're talking about when you're talking about the cliches, but their importance and the way they were.
That's right. There are so many symbols in science fiction art. For instance, it's only been in the last 4 or 5 years that you could really get away with a spaceship that wasn't a needle. Spaceships were shaped like needles, and that was bloody well that, because it has a significance, a symbolic significance, the thrust of the needle outward, the drive. It's much, you could say it was Freudian, but it's much more basic than Freudian, because it is the movement of the life force out into the universe. This is where we've got to go. This is where we belong. The shell of the egg is broken. We're on our way out. There is no use trying to crawl back into it. And we feel this in our symbols. And the symbol of the woman, and this is a curious thing, the symbol of the woman and the symbol of the spaceship are on the one side antithetical and on the other side absolutely identical. And I am wondering what is going to happen as what is going to be the alternative now that you've taken it away from a bunch of introverted little boys and turned it over to, let us say, almost equally introverted big girls? There are going to be some major changes, and I can't begin to imagine what they're going to be. I think it's going to be fascinating.
That's interesting. When you're talking about the symbols that are used for something and how, like, a spaceship always had to be a long needle-like mm-hmm. structure, is that, do you think, because the illustrators and the writers tended to think in those symbols, that they were natural symbols to think in and that they happened to be very good representations? Or do you think that fans develop certain images of what something should look like and it's difficult to break out of that because
a great deal of it was exactly that, although I think the symbols develop because they begin with a basic validity. Most of our symbols go back to a primitive man and haven't basically changed that much. These are the things that draw a response in you, in your blood and bones, the same as they did with your ancestors. On the other hand, there is the very curious effect of technology. As we learn, we make minor changes, all right. The needle-shaped spaceship always had fins of some sort or other, usually with its engines and pods at the end. And this was the way they started practicing with their rockets. Very quickly they found out that there was absolutely no way of controlling the rocket so long as you had the engines at the end of these fins. The engine had to be directly under and directly in line with the main axis of the vehicle. So we not only extended the needle concept with the Saturn V and the Apollo program, we even narrowed it. It became a much more specific needle. I found personally that the first rockets were very disappointing.
Have you ever drawn something, you know, pretty much sheerly out of your imagination and found years later that scientists were just about developing the image that you had drawn?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that. In fashions that I put on my characters, this has happened fairly frequently. As far as the gadgetry itself, actually the problem has tended to work the opposite direction. For instance, when I first started into science fiction, you could convey the impression of the manipulation of gigantic forces by showing great bus bars and big resistors and insulators taller than a man and all the sort of gadgetry that you could see in miniature in any power plant. And now we come down to 1977 when the whole bloomin' thing is done in a little black box the size of a pack of cigarettes. Well, this doesn't make for a very good illustration. I mean, what are you going to do? It's we have found ourselves cut off a great deal from... let me go back here. A perfect example of it is a cover I did years ago for A.J. Boudreaux's story, Who?, which showed a cybernetic man, a man with a steel head and a steel arm, against a background which, as painted, was a mixture of electronic tubes and human neurons. Couldn't do it now, because about 4 or 5 years after that cover came out, the electronic tube, the radio tube, was replaced completely. And a transistor just wouldn't do the job in that type of design. So this is the sort of thing that really flips you. What do you do for a spacesuit when the old piece you find that the space armor won't work because the practical requirements of space have made it impossible to use? So we have to find alternatives.
Those alternatives, looking more into the imaginative and completely... fantasy realms
always
of creation.
How do you illustrate teleportation, for instance? How do you show in a still picture what a man is doing when he levitates? How do you show that he isn't just jumping up in the air or possibly falling down? But we find ways to do it. I've had both problems and solved them more or less successfully.
One of the things that I think you often must have had to draw is images of a fear, of impending danger. What are some of the techniques or devices that you can draw upon to really symbolize?
Oh, we have a tremendous, almost an encyclopedia of techniques that we can use. You see, designing an illustration is very much like designing a stage set. You use color for its symbolic values. You use line for its symbolic values. A sharp, pointed, menacing, thorny bush can set the mood for a whole illustration, while everything seems to be quite peaceful and pleasant in the picture. The presence of these jagged, rugged images show you that something is about to happen. This sort of thing. The problem of communicating mood is not a new one. It's the very same thing that the finest artists of the Renaissance were trying to do. They were creating they used the richest symbolism and the richest textures and colors that were available to them to give the intensity of religious feeling. Incidentally, this is another area in which I have put in a great deal of study, because in addition to my other work, I've done something over 450 portraits of Franciscan saints over the years. Believe me, the difference between doing religious illustration and science fiction illustration is not as great as you would think. Because basically the problems of communicating the concepts are exactly the same.
Well, in taking your statement perhaps a little too literally, I'll say that visiting Notre Dame, I was amazed at the gargoyles. I mean, it looked like... I don't know why, this will also sound very naive, I'm sure, but I was just amazed to think of people in that century coming up with these, you know, very bizarre images that I think would work very well either in fantasy illustration or in a science fiction film.
The real father of fantasy illustration, of course, was Hieronymus Bosch. and a whole coterie of Northern Renaissance illustrators. Of course, their predilection was for scenes of torture and hellfire and damnation, but they had a lot of fun with the gardens of earthly delights and that sort of thing, too.
Who have been the illustrators and painters who you have been most excited by? And who have influenced you the most?
There are so many that I have enjoyed so much that it would be very difficult to pin it down to one. But Gustav Klimt, of course, Caravaggio for his light, David and Ungris for the precision of their drawing, coming down to the illustrators, of course, N.C. Wyeth and Frederick Remington. I happen to be a Charlie Russell nut, too. Going into the actual field of science fiction illustration, my two tin gods were Virgil Finlay, who I think was the most underrated and highly skilled penman of the last 100 years. This is a man who had developed a style completely different from the more popular Franklin Booth type of approach, and almost literally starved to death for lack of appreciation. But he was in a direct line of development from Audrey Beardsley through Norman Lindsay to Virgil Finlay, and a greater penman never exists. There was never anybody who was any finer than Finlay for a sheer technique and imagery. But my personal delight was Ed Cartier, who was an illustrator for Astounding back in the late 30s and early 40s. He had a perfectly delightful sense of humor. And as a matter of fact, that was the one thing that did restrict his work in some respects, because he couldn't resist the little touch of humor. So that one really wouldn't give Cartier an illustration project that required high tragedy. He had too much fun doing them, and the reader enjoyed them too much to accept anything really tragic, while at the same time he could produce some of the damnedest monsters you ever saw.
If you're just tuning in now, I'm speaking with science fiction artist Kelly Fries, who has a one-man show this weekend at the Philomathian Hall, Room in College Hall on the Penn campus, and he's going to be there this evening for the opening. How involved are you with science? Some scientists, you know, are really caught up in science fiction.
Oh, yes.
And I'm wondering if you are equally caught up in science, or if you think this is like a nice jumping-off point for fantasy.
No. As a matter of fact, while I like fantasy, there is very little connection between the two things. Science fiction and fantasy have almost nothing in common. Fantasy is, whether in literature or in illustration, so long as it is internally consistent, anything goes. Now, in science fiction, this is not true. In most cases, you can be allowed one major hypothesis for a story. From that, everything should follow logically and rationally. When it doesn't, your science fiction degenerates into fantasy and loses all of its force. If we're going to have fantasy, I like it to be pure, out-and-out, wild fantasy. A beautiful example of that would be The Last Unicorn. On the other hand, science fiction, pure Simon, pure hardcore science fiction, might be typified by Hal Clements' Mesquinites in Mission of Gravity, or by Poul Anderson's Tau Zero. The problems, setting up a specific problem for a group of human beings with human characteristics, and following it through on a logical, rational level. Now, the problem for the illustrator is very much the same. I have to go into careful research in lots of cases because as I what I mentioned about abstraction not fitting, if I want to show a piece of machinery that does not exist, let's say a time scanner, as used by the Paratime Police in one of H. Beam Piper's stories. My time scanner is very carefully designed to be a piece of equipment that any radio ham would expect to work. The cases are battered up a little bit. The cables are slightly frayed, and so on. He feels the texture. He sees the rivets, the screw heads, and so forth. This gives him the feeling of reality in a machine, which is totally impossible. Now, in other cases, we get into things like doing an illustration of a radio telescope, a giant radio telescope. For things like this, I have a very large address book, lots of phone numbers, and lots of friends who will come up with the answer to almost any question that I can ask. This is probably my most useful tool. And when I'm doing a story, whether it deals with radio telescopes or quasars or oceanography, for a week or two, I will be an expert in that area. And then it goes out of my mind just as if it had been washed out with a flood. I can be an expert this week and an utter moron on the same subject next week.
Does space travel fascinate you?
Only in so far as I'd like to have a chance to do some of it. I find that the moon lost a great deal of its glamour for me when somebody walked on it, but I wouldn't mind making a trip to Mars.
You have not, to my knowledge, illustrated comic books.
Not exactly. I did at times do some interior work for Mad Magazine, but ordinarily they would be double page spreads or one shot items. I'm not a continuity type artist. You see, the difference between a comics artist and an illustrator is a real polar difference. What the comics illustrator is doing is taking a very rudimentary script and expanding this with visual methods. There is virtually no description in a comic script. The illustrator puts all of it in himself, and he can go hog wild about it, such as you may see in the First Kingdom material. In some of Wally Wood's old stuff, tremendous detail of background, building up the whole thing. The comic illustrator is telling you the story as he goes along. Now, the magazine illustrator, the story illustrator, goes at it entirely differently because he is taking the story and trying to distill all of the imagery of the story down into one small, significant image that gives you the feeling of the whole thing. It's exactly opposite approaches.
That's
very seldom that a guy can go both directions.
So, we know the direction you've gone in. I just want to go back a step again. We were talking about your interest in science, and you said that the moon lost some of its romance and interest to you when somebody walked on it. Yet your posters for space travel and all the NASA projects have been hanging in the Smithsonian. I mean, it was almost like a commercial advertisement for space travel.
Well,
I imagine that you support the program.
Oh yes, indeed. But perhaps the significant thing about the space posters was the fact that I produced these at the time when the program was beginning to wind down. And one of the most popular ones was the one showing the three phantom ships on the ocean against the moon and the rocket taking off with the caption, "Suppose Isabella had said no." And my own feeling might best be expressed by another one of them, which says, "Look out, way out. That's where the real action is."
Okay. I want to just touch briefly on another aspect of your work that I'm sure many of the people who are listening now are familiar with. your work for Mad Magazine. I want to just ask you briefly about the character that we all know now as Alfred E. Newman, who you drew for a number of years. What's his history? Where did he come from?
Oh, well, his history in Mad Magazine was short and abrupt. He came up first in the background in several of the old comic size, and he was known at that point as Melvin Kosnowski, and suddenly was translated into Alfred E. Newman and became the cover character. But the original of this little guy has been floating around since the year one. We have seen newspapers that go back to the 1880s with exactly the same face. Evidently, he first turned up as a typical Central European immigrant. The same lock of hair over his eye, the same cocked eye, the same missing tooth, and the same big ears, in a string tie and broadcloth suit. And with all of the changes that he went through over the through the succeeding years, that face still remained the same until I have a psychology text which was printed in 1922, which shows exactly the same face. Evidently, they took it for granted that this was a photograph rather than a drawing. The exact same face, Alfred E. Newman, as a perfect example of the macrocephalic idiot. They took him quite seriously even back then. But we were only able to verify his existence with specific dates back to 1917. But he has been around that long.
Now, how did you find him?
Well, as I believe I mentioned, the little green man on my book, The Art of Science Fiction, was originally painted for as a cover for Astounding Science Fiction. And it was on the stands at a time I was delivering another job to Ballantine Books at the time they were doing the first of the Mad paperbacks. And it was Jerry DiFuccio who spotted the little green man, spotted me. He says, "Ah, you're Kelly Fries. You painted this cover. How would you like to do Alfred E. Newman for us?" He said, "I'd be delighted. How much do you pay?" Which, after all, for an illustrator, is the most important question of all.
What, before you leave us this afternoon, what are some of the other works that we can keep our eyes open of yours that will be coming out soon? I look forward to seeing the Queen album jacket that you just mentioned.
Yes, you'll see another one of my very favorites on the Cademan recording of The Green Hills of Earth, Robert Heinlein's famous story. Let's see, the last issue of Analog has one, but the ones that you'll be most interested in is a line I have undertaken to edit, a line of quality paperbacks called Starblaze, in which I will not only illustrate the stories, but I will have the opportunity to choose what stories I illustrate.
Oh, the artist
now
becomes
this
editor.
This is going to be fun.
Great. Very good. How exciting. I want to thank you very much for being here this afternoon.
It's been a real pleasure. I've enjoyed it.
I've been speaking with Kelly Fries, and his paintings and science fiction illustrations will be on display through the weekend at the Philomathian Room in College Hall, that's on the University of Pennsylvania campus. He'll be there this evening to speak with the people who are showing up and also to sign, I believe, the limited edition posters that have been created.
Bring your old Astounding Science Fiction.
Yeah,
I'll sign them, too.
Great. Okay. And you'll be there from, what, 7 to 8:30, I believe?
About, yes.
Okay. And also, if you're interested in pursuing prints that are probably out of print in their initial renderings, there is a book of Kelly Fries's work called The Art of Science Fiction, which is available, and that has some fine reprints of his work in them. Thank you again very much for being here.
Thank you.